It's April 30th, 2014. This is episode 37 of The Job. I'm here with Candace Briglib. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Ray.
How are you?
I am doing quite well. How are you?
Good. I had a lot of fun at the, I guess we had a lot of fun at the Specialty Coffee Association of America conference.
Sure did.
We hung out with a lot of cool people, went to a party or two, and
man, those coffee people can drink.
Yeah.
That's all I was not prepared for.
Yeah.
But I think we had a good time. Seattle's fantastic, and there are so many good restaurants. I think sometimes, and I felt like this was San Francisco too, it's like you're in Portland, and I hear a lot about how Portland has like so much good food and all of that, which it does. But then I got to Seattle and I realized Seattle has so much good food. It's just every meal we went somewhere different and cool, and I don't know, maybe it's just something that's just happening.
We went to Sitka and Spruce.
Sitka and Spruce.
And Jody's recommendation, we went to Shanghai Garden. On Dwayne's recommendation, we went to... Oh my gosh, I'm going to forget the name of the sandwich shop.
I was going to say Pasoles, but I think that's wrong. Or is that right? It starts with a P. You can do it.
Yeah.
So while you look that up, right as we were heading to Seattle, we ran into Bunk Sandwiches for breakfast sandwiches as we were driving up, and we ran into Tommy from Bunk and told him we were going to Seattle, and he said if we were going to stop anywhere, it would be this one sandwich shop. And then as soon as we got up there...
Paseo.
Yeah. Yeah. And as soon as we got up there, also our friend Jody, who lived in Seattle for a while, also suggested that that was somewhere that she went all the time when she lived there.
She said she used to drive up there from Portland to get those sandwiches, yeah.
They were pretty darn good.
It's different than what Bunk does, but also excellent.
I got a really spicy... Yeah.
Oh, man. Those were so good.
Spicy prawn sandwich out of this world. Yeah. I could see getting a craving for that, and if I didn't have kids that would be in the back seat screaming, I might actually drive up to Seattle for a night.
They use like a really good combination of spices too. It gave it a really, really rich
spice, delicious. And then like super creamy sauce, and they're caramelized onions on every sandwich, and they were cut super thick and then caramelized just beautifully. I think that's part of the secret too.
We also got to see Scott, our friend from La Marzocco up there, who had the GS3, a bunch of demo units out they put together with all sorts of cool finishes, like one with wooden accents and one with glass, which is really cool because you could put your logo on the side and it like kind of had depth.
I'm a little jealous. Yeah. I didn't see that. Yeah.
We got to pull a shot on there of...
What?
You get to pick which kind of coffee you wanted to try. And
you get to pull the shot yourself?
Yeah. They had a bunch of... They were just out for...
That's so either cool.
To play with it and see what you
think. I guess it is a coffee conference. I guess there'd be a few people walking around that know how to pull a shot.
And at La Marzocca's main booth, they had like five rotating roasteries pulling shots. So like, you know, Four Barrel was there, Stumptown was there. There was a Spy House, I think they're called, in Minneapolis. I talked to them. Really cool what they're doing. So amazing, like, to think of how bad the coffee was in Minneapolis. But it's funny, I was talking to the guy, and I said, oh, hey, I used to have a coffee house that I owned in Minneapolis. But we served really, there were no roasteries to speak of. And he's like, oh, yeah, who? And I said, you know, Rudy's. And he's like, oh, yeah, on West 7th. I was like, yeah. And he's like, you guys had the same guy make the sign that we did. And I was like, oh, yeah, Pergo. So this guy used to make these cool, like, wrought iron signs that he would cut, and there were just these giant, you know, lovely signs that were very striking. And I had worked with him when I helped them start CyberX, Minneapolis's first cyber cafe, in the mid-90s. And the guy was, like, hilarious, and he did great work. And so when we opened Rudy's, we were like, well, we blew an inordinate amount of our budget on this sign. But apparently, so did this roastery, and I would love to go and see their space. I saw photos of it, and it was very, very impressive and striking. Definitely using the space, those old Minneapolis warehouse spaces, you know. Like, there's no shortage of exposed brick in Minneapolis, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Noticed.
We saw that. And now I'm back and my allergies are acting up and it's driving me crazy.
But not in Seattle? Maybe you just need to live closer to the water. Was that sound breeze?
Yeah.
The salty air.
Yeah, maybe. It could be it. You know, every year when they publish like a weekly like allergy map of the U.S. and it's like, I remember last year for months, literally months, there was one little dot of red on the map. Like they're all color coded and you don't want to be where it's red. And it was just Portland. Like, how did I end up moving to the one city that has the worst allergies in America? Like, and then they'd list them, and, like, Portland was always, like, in the top five. It's, like, ridiculous. What? And I'm serious. I'll put a link in the show notes. Anyway.
I'm laughing because you found this chart, and then you follow it.
Yeah. It's one of my little dashboard widgets. In that time of year. Yeah. I mean, it's not like I can even do anything about it. It's just there for me to seethe over the choices that I've made in my life.
So you can see what kind of day you're going to have. Like, you can start out in the right mood.
Shitty again.
Man.
This week's guest is Seely Pines. You know, I won't even go into it. She has so many crazy cool projects going on. Let's just talk to Seely. Hi, Seely.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well.
Thanks for coming down today.
I'm very happy to be here.
To get started, why don't you tell me about your name? Where does your name come from?
My name is Hebrew.
Okay.
I'm Israeli. I moved to the States with my family when I was 6 years old. And they had not anticipated that English-speaking people would need to say my name, so they didn't really take that into account when they were naming me.
Okay.
So, yeah, but actually, even in Israel, it's not the most common name, so.
Is it a family name, or was it?
It is. Okay. It's my grandmother's name.
Okay.
And it's also kind of an obscure biblical name. It's in the sort of begat section of the Bible, where it's like such and such begat such and such.
Just where they're name dropping.
Yeah, it's total name dropping section. I had no idea about that until a couple years ago when someone pointed it out to me. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if we search for your name on Google, if you'd come up first or...
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah. It's me and like a couple other people, but they're all imitators.
Right.
So.
Right.
You know, I'm the original.
Original and best.
Of course.
So you came to the States when you were still pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get interested in, like, graphic design or the creative profession? Where was your first spark?
You know, I had no idea that graphic design existed. And I feel like that's kind of the story of a lot of people, sort of Gen X and prior. Whereas now, you almost can't grow up without an awareness of design as a practice of some kind. Like, I'm just so impressed by how younger and younger and younger people are interested in it when I had absolutely no idea that these things were designed by a person. Like, it didn't occur to me. But, you know, so I, in retrospect, you kind of look back and go, I spent a lot more time on the cover of my book report than on the book report when I was in junior high. So I guess I was pretty drawn to, you know, the visual, the kind of visual exploration of the subject more so than reporting back on it. I, much like a lot of my contemporaries, it was the rise of the internet that kind of got me in the door. And when I finished college, I started kind of looking for any job that would have me as sort of a, you know, social science major, being like, how does this apply to the real world? Oh, it doesn't. So I just took a job with like a content provider for AOL at the time and was doing production and stuff. And then I realized through doing that that somebody was actually designing stuff that I was just coding, and was like, I want to be on that side of things. I don't want to be, you know, just kind of making other people's designs happen. So I went back to school and went to Parsons for kind of really just a year. I already had a degree, so I wasn't really in it for the degree. I was just kind of like, I need to learn some basics about typography and layout and all that good stuff that they teach at respectable design schools. And at the time, there was such like a gold rush going on with the dot-com boom that it was really easy to get a job. So all I needed to do really was get to the point where I could get, you know, a basic portfolio together, and then I got snapped right up. I mean, it was such a different landscape then than it is now. So I, you know, just jumped right off into a job and learned a ton on the job. I learned a lot more working than in school. You know, that was pretty much a better scenario of like getting paid to learn instead of paying to learn. So I left before I finished my degree, because I was just like, well, this was my goal, was to work, and I'm working and I'm building out my portfolio, and who needs anything more than that? So yeah, that was my very long-winded answer.
Sure. Okay. So you're still in New York at this point?
Yeah. So I was in New York for Parsons. Like, I moved there for school, was there for a year, and then for 2 years I was working for a company that was actually kind of a subsidiary of a Canadian record label. Okay. And we were doing tons of music web stuff that was not necessarily tied to the label. So we had a huge client in BMG Music, and we were doing all the artist sites for them. And then one of our better known large scale projects was one iteration of David Bowie's BowieNet web presence. And so I was there during that time, which was really exciting and fun. And then, you know, after 3 years in New York and kind of getting on into my late 20s, I realized, wow, you either need to make like a lot of money to stay here, or you're just going to be like hustling for the rest of your life. And I was kind of ready to come back to the West Coast, so I moved back to San Francisco.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how long was it between when you went to San Francisco and when you ended up in Portland?
Well, so I grew up in Berkeley.
Okay.
And went to school in LA, came back to San Francisco for a number of years before New York. And then I was in San Francisco for 5 years after my stint in New York. And my husband and I visited a friend of ours that had moved to Portland, just really for like, you know, giggles, like, we've never been to Oregon, let's take a road trip and go through like, you know, all the awesome tourist spots, you know, Crater Lake and whatnot, and spend a little bit of time in Portland hanging out with our friend and go back home, like, no designs for anything. And when by the end of our time here, we had been sucked in. We were like, oh my god, it's really nice, and hey, you can buy a house here, like, yeah, that's really unheard of in the Bay Area. I mean, at the time it was like, oh, we're always going to be renting forever. So it took us a couple years to engineer a move up here, but we did, and been here since 2006.
Okay. It seems like you got comfortable pretty quickly and then started getting involved in events and stuff like that. How did you find the community in Portland, and how hard was it to get involved in all of the events that you work with?
Well, you know, I, for most of my work life, was very heads down and not very involved in community events or well-networked or anything. It was just like, I'm doing the work. I've been working with the same studio for like 12 years now, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah, this is going to be 12 years. So, you know, it was just like I'm heads down on my projects. And, you know, I started doing some of my own side projects and just trying to vary up what I was doing in general. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, you know, I'm pretty bad at getting involved in things in any way other than like being responsible for some piece of them and making them happen and having to show up somewhere and being, you know, sort of have to answer to a set of responsibilities. So I knew that in order to get involved with the community, I would have to, you know, produce something or contribute in some way. And my friend John was running the Creative Mornings chapter in Los Angeles. And mm-hmm. I mean, like everyone else, I was watching all the videos that were coming out of New York and LA sure. and San Francisco and all those early cities. Loved the videos, but had never been to an event. And he came to visit and was telling me about just the experience of organizing and what it's like at the actual event with just people coming back every month and just the good vibes. And I was like, wow, that sounds awesome. And why isn't there a chapter in Portland, you know? Mm-hmm. So at the time, there was no formal process for kind of becoming a chapter at Creative Mornings. Mm-hmm. It was sort of early on in the ramp up. And so I just kind of pitched through my friend, you know, and said, like, let me see if I can pull something together. And I had no business doing this because I didn't know anybody.
Right.
I was really poorly connected. It was totally like just brazen. And I just figured if I have a connection to Creative Mornings, then people will at least know what that is and have a reason to talk to me. And mm-hmm.
They'll have to talk to
they'll,
me.
They'll have to deal with me. So yeah, I just kind of decided that was what I was going to do. And, they took me on mostly because my friend John is, you know, like really close with them and they trusted him
right.
to their peril. So I started going around and seeing like what other design events were going on at the time and making sure to meet all the people that were organizing those events because mm-hmm. Portland is not New York. I mean, you want to make sure that you're not booking the same person,
sure.
you know, for multiple events at the same time. And so I was just kind of like kissing rings around town. And so that's how I met Eric Hillerns, who at the time was running Design Speaks. And we just struck up a friendship, and there were so many cool things happening around town. You know, all the stuff that Kate Bingham and Burt was doing at PSU, and Yvonne Emerson Perez had started up WeMake, and we just knew all these cool people doing cool things. And Eric has been in Portland for much longer than I have, so he's seen some attempts at Design Week happen in the past, but they were a lot more like top-down efforts where it was like, we'll get the city involved, and then, you know,
sure.
and those things take forever because of bureaucracy, and, right. you know, all the good intentions in the world can't really move that boulder uphill. So we were just looking at it and going, hey, we know enough people that are doing stuff already. Let's just tell everybody to aim their events at 1 week in October, and we'll call it Design Week. And it was kind of like this funny thing that we were like, there's going to be maybe 10 events and we'll call it Design Week, and it's totally cheeky, like, and we'll do it and put a stake in the ground and see if anything happens. And it just snowballed. Like, it was amazing because getting all those, whatever, 10 initial events together and all the amazing people that organized them around a table, well, they knew other people that, you know, were interested in kind of instigating some kind of content, you know, or whatever. And by the time the first Design Week rolled around, it was 40 plus events, you know, 60 plus open houses. And we organized that by the seat of our pants in like 5 months. So the response was so great that we just thought, there's something here. I mean, you know, clearly we didn't even realize like that we would need to have any central organization for it. We just thought we're all running events, so it's like a collective. And and very quickly it became clear, like, no, there's a need for, like, Design Week to be an entity of some kind that pulls in a lot of great stuff. So last year was very much about that, about kind of building the infrastructure that you need to sustainably run a festival every year, you know? So, yeah, it was a one thing leads to the next kind of experience of getting involved in the community.
It seems like a theme here with both of these, both Creative Mornings and Design Week, is that you kind of recognize that there's an underserved need for sort of a central point for the community, the design community, to rally around in Portland.
Yes.
And sort of, well, chose good vehicles for doing that. I mean, Creative Mornings, like you say, I definitely was watching the videos, and then I was like, oh, wait a minute, it's in Portland, this is exciting. And you know, same with Design Week, it seemed very informal, and by the time it, you know, when I heard about it, and then by the time it rolled around, it was like, oh, this is kind of pro.
Yeah,
this is,
man,
pretty awesome.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Yeah, I mean, I think that people don't take things seriously until they see the there, you know? And so it was interesting the first year. We had this crazy period of a month before Design Week actually started, where once we had launched the website, people realized, like, oh, they're really doing this. They're not just talking about doing it. Like, they're really doing it. We're gonna make this happen. And we had all these people get on the bus, like, right at the last minute, because it was, like, really energizing to see something actually taking shape instead of people just being like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can talk and talk, and there are a lot of great ideas for how to do this stuff, but executing it is an entirely different thing. And when people see that people are on the ground getting stuff, like, done, then they're so excited to join the effort, you know?
Why do you think the whole concept of, and maybe you can't speak to this because you're just the Portland chapter, or you just work at the Portland chapter, but why do you think Creative Mornings as a whole took off like it did? Because it seems like it's just kind of maybe snowballed. I mean,
it definitely
so many chapters
has.
Now.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy and wonderful. It's kind of viral, you know, in its way. You know, I think that it's really hard to, in the same way that it's hard to quantify, like, what makes content go viral, I think it's hard to say why certain, like, events or ideas or whatever kind of strike a nerve, but I can see that some of the ingredients are prerequisites for it having become as popular as it is, and so that includes the fact that it's free. Oddly, the fact that it's in the morning, I think, has to do with it in terms of the live events, because A, you're not competing with other events. B, people can do it and then just, like, go about their day, so it's not competing with their plans after work. And C, it's just kind of like a really, it feels like a low commitment kind of thing, I think, of just being like, oh, I'll just drop by, you know?
Yeah.
So it's real casual and it has that vibe. And I think people also really sense the fact that it's all run on, you know, hustle and smiles, like that it's just good people with good intentions doing something for absolutely no reason other than that it's great to do it. So I think that's part of it, is just that it provides kind of a space where there's no agenda, like there's no association that's running it for a particular discipline. There's no affiliation really with anything. It's like everybody's welcome. Creativity is greater than just design, so it's like really broad, and I love that about it, because as designers, I think we can sometimes get really wrapped up in looking at other work that other designers are doing, and you get really drawn into a bit of like a navel-gazy kind of way of searching out inspiration and new ideas. And the nice thing about Creative Mornings is like, let's talk to chefs, let's talk to biologists, let's talk to people who are doing things entirely outside of our niche. And so it infuses new ideas and kind of cross-pollinates a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I think people sense that and really are juiced about that.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of really fresh, really inspiring content.
Yeah, I know that usually most or all of our team goes to those, and I always feel good about it because it's kind of like a lot of those people who are talking are just like our clients.
Yes.
Or they could be our clients. And I think it's important as a designer not to forget that your client is actually really creative too. Probably more creative than you are.
Right. Yeah, and they know the set of problems that they're trying
exactly.
to solve.
Exactly. I think sometimes as a designer you take for granted the someone's expertise in a certain field and the fact that they've thought as creatively as you have about, you know, where this pixel goes or that one or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. So you taught while you were in New York at Parsons. Is that cool? Is that true?
It's true and it was cool.
Okay.
It was both. It was both true and cool. Yeah, I went to Parsons and so I was connected to the school that way, but also someone that I was working with was teaching. It was a fairly new program at the time. It was a graduate program that was essentially like a new media program. And, you know, in like the late 90s, early aughts, it was such the wild, wild west of, you know, internet education. Nobody in the schools knew what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of these design schools were like Swiss-based design schools with really traditional kind of approach, which is great, and I wish every designer could be trained in all of that stuff. But also they had no idea what to do about all these new technologies. So it was really like this time where someone who's like in their mid-20s knew more about some of the stuff that was going on with you know, web design than
mm-hmm.
people who had been in the graphic design field or teaching in the schools for much, much longer. So it was like a weird little opportunity for someone who doesn't have really the credentials that you would expect
mm-hmm.
to be teaching at
right.
the graduate level.
Right.
Which is kind of, I mean, I thought it was kind of absurd at the time, but you could sense it even then, like that it was just like nobody knows what's going on here except for the people who are in the trenches, you
right.
know, and everything is rewriting itself so quickly. It was so hard for these institutions to catch up with it. And I feel like it's still a challenge, though. Many schools are doing such a better job now than when we were kind of coming up.
Yeah. I think it's I definitely sense that it's hard for them to keep pace because we still have, you know, people coming to us from some schools where they're like, so when do we build stuff in Flash? It's like,
whoa. Never?
Sound of crickets. Yeah, like, I'm sorry. We stopped doing that in when the iPhone came out. I don't know, like in the 2007. It's funny when you mentioned that, I imagined like Gutenberg in his 20s, like, you guys don't understand. This is the future.
Right.
He's, like, giving classes in the evening. But
that's exactly what it was like. And I feel like it still is. I mean, really, you know, most shops that take students on, essentially, like, as apprentices or bring them on as junior designers, realize that they have to invest an enormous amount in that person
uh-huh.
to get them up to speed with, you know, the state of the art.
Mm-hmm.
And even for us, I mean, I don't know how you feel, but it's crazy keeping up with what goes on, you know?
Yeah.
You just really have to constantly be on top of your game and constantly, like, looking at, you know, every tiny step forward and keeping pace with it. And then that information is, you know, is really hard for anything that's curriculum-based to kind of fold in really quickly. Mm-hmm. Though there are specialized programs now that I think their whole purpose is to do that, right?
Oh, sure.
And if they have adjunct instructors that are in the field, it's a lot easier to kind of like stay on the cutting edge. But yeah, it's a challenge. It's a challenge with the shifting sands. I mean, I feel like graphic design didn't change very much for a very long time. And then suddenly when it moved into the interactive space, and it's basically an entirely different discipline, right? It's changing constantly now.
Yeah. I mean, it's for me, it's like a lot of times someone will come up with a technique just randomly. That's not like a new version of any web browser made this possible. It's just that someone figured it out. And then it solves a problem that you might have had forever. And it's like, you know, when I was learning design, it was kind of like, well, here's your, you know, French curve. You can make all kinds of curves with that. That's the only tool you need to make a curve. And it's just crazy now.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the principles, right, are the same in terms of, like, good design. But... yeah, the way that things are executed, and certainly like a lot of the workflows and just UX and all that stuff is like totally different world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite part of the design process for you personally?
Yeah, I mean, I think like everyone tend to like the front end of the project a lot because you're learning so much, right? The whole thing is educating yourself about the problem and really thinking broadly about all the different things that you can bring to that. When stuff starts getting further down the line, I think it's really much more challenging to stay fresh and engaged with it rather than just like editing and fixing and, you know, kind of getting lost in the trees. So because that front part of the process is by nature so exploratory, it's, I think, the most obviously fun part of the process.
So you said you've been with the same agency for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say who that is?
Yeah, it's Fine Design Group.
Okay.
And so we started out in San Francisco. So I was working with them in the Bay Area. And that was after the dot bomb, right? Like, I was so lucky to get a job before that happened in New York and have a good, strong working portfolio of real projects. And then when I moved to the Bay Area, like, everything had been decimated. It was complete luck to get a job at all at that time because the Bay Area was like emptying out. People were just like, can't find work, going back home to mom and dad's house, like, you know, really total destruction. But so I lucked into that job, and at the time they were shifting from like a print studio into an interactive studio. So it was really fun to be part of that process. And it was a really small group at the time, you know, we were like six people. And so worked with them in San Francisco for 4 years. And, you know, we wanted to move to Portland. And when we came up here, I sort of looked at the landscape and was like, you know, there are a lot of really like small shops and then big dogs. There weren't a lot of like these medium-sized employers. And so I was like, you know, it'd be cool if I could keep my job. So I asked them if I could just freelance or, you know, telecommute or something, work something out. And they're like, well, you know, we actually have a contractor up there right now anyway. If you want to move up there, like, why don't we just open up a little satellite office or something? I was like, okay, cool. So we opened up the small office, and then the craziest thing happened where everybody from San Francisco slowly, slowly was like, oh, there is a place where we can go. So they moved up, and a lot of new hires happened here, and it became the primary office over time. So yeah, we opened in 2006 or 2007 up here, and then it's now, you know, 30 some odd people.
Wow, that's really interesting.
In Portland. Huh. Yeah. With still a small presence in San Francisco and one in Michigan, but primarily we're based here now.
Okay, wow. On the subject of your, one of your projects is called, I hope I'm saying this right, New Ketubah?
That's perfect.
Oh, good.
Well
okay.
done.
Okay. what can you tell me about that?
So that was one of my side projects, like when I started getting a little, getting some ants in my pants
mm-hmm.
a while back, thinking like, let's diversify what I'm doing. I got married and there's this, you know, traditional marriage contract, essentially,
mm-hmm.
in Jewish weddings that you sign during the ceremony and it's considered kind of like a, you know, a good deed to make it as beautiful as possible. And then
mm-hmm.
you basically hang it in your home as artwork. So I was like, you know, just looking for one to use in my wedding and it was impossible to find something modern. Like everything was sort of in the illuminated manuscript style and very beautiful. Like you had really wonderful artists that, you know, many calligraphers do this and really beautiful stuff, but just totally not my style. And I was like, all right, well, I'm gonna make my own. And then a friend of mine asked me to make one. And then I was like, okay, there's just like nobody doing this.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it was really kind of the last untouched little niche where modern design had not arrived. And so...
I doubt that's true, but yeah. I would love it if it was.
I know, right? So I was like, all right, this is a super niche thing, but nobody's doing this. So
mm-hmm.
again, kind of sensed a need
yeah.
and started designing like a little collection for that and learned a lot about all the different texts because... You know, the texts that I used in my wedding, and many of them, are kind of modern commitment texts, which are kind of like vows. So people, you know, will have it in English and in Hebrew, kind of like as a nod to the tradition. But there's also a traditional text, which is like a canonized text that has been used for thousands of years. And it is not very romantic. It's essentially like a prenup.
Right.
You know, and in Israel, it is essentially the same as the marriage certificate that you would go get at City Hall because, you know, church and state are not separated
right.
in Israel. So like the, you know, if you have a Jewish wedding in Israel, you're getting as like a state document, this religious document. And, at the time that it was created, it was a pretty, progressive document in that it sort of ensured the rights of the woman, like you are entitled to the following things in
mm-hmm.
the marriage. Now it reads as this completely archaic thing
sure.
that almost sounds like sexist now, but some people still use this text because it is the traditional text. So I had to really educate myself about it because it's written in Aramaic, which nobody really
sure.
reads
no,
or yeah anything anymore. So kind of had to learn about that and learn about how to properly fill it out so that it's kosher. Because if an Orthodox rabbi is, you know, is officiating, then it has to be right and it needs to hold up in a religious court and like all this stuff. And so
huh.
huge learning curve for that.
Yeah.
And then the most interesting thing happened after a few years of doing that, all these other people sort of started coming into the market and doing like modern ketubot. And
uh-huh.
so I see a lot more, like I see options out there on the market now that are not my designs that I would totally have bought. Like I would have bought that if I
right.
had had that option at the time. So there's lots of great stuff going on now. But it's exciting because it's kind of like rethinking this really old art form in
mm-hmm.
the context of, you know, contemporary design. And the history of this document is so interesting because it always reflects the place in which it's made. So you see a ketubah that's made, you know, in like, whatever, 17th century Italy, and it looks like 17th century Italy. Mm-hmm. And you see one that's made, you know, in like, even earlier in Iran, and it looks, you know, a lot like the designs of a mosque in Iran mm-hmm. at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it really reflects the culture in which it lives. You know, that's one of the interesting things about the Jewish diaspora is that people are scattered throughout the world, and the culture is informed by the resident culture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a lot of fun, and it's been really interesting. And I'm actually really kind of excited because I'm going to be launching some new stuff this year for that in collaboration with a really amazing typographer in Israel.
Oh, cool.
He's an experimental typographer who has just incredible work. And so we're kind of going to release a new set of things together this year. So that's being reinvigorated a bit. I honestly got like a little bit bored with it
mm-hmm.
for a while. So it's really interesting, these long-term projects that you do and thinking of ways to stay interested in them
yeah.
and change up, you mm-hmm. know, and keep them vital. Yeah.
I think that's an unrecognized, certainly for me, that applies to web design is like, especially because it's so moving so quickly, it's like if you aren't passionate about it, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because some young 20-something punk's going to come along and like just run circles around you.
Right.
You know?
Well, in a lot of ways, design is like a young person's game in the sense of, you know, the way culture kind of chews through design,
sure.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, youth culture is king in our culture,
mm-hmm.
and so there is that sort of feeling that I'm increasingly having where I'm like, oh, this is a young person's game, and I'm so old. On the other hand, you know, with web design, the large-scale projects are so complex
yeah.
and require so much more than aesthetics. I mean, aesthetics are really like a tiny portion of
mm-hmm.
what they entail.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not a young person's game. That takes a long time to
mm-hmm.
learn, and it's a craft, you know? So I feel like we do have a little bit of job security on that front, at least.
Yeah. Well, I feel like as we grow up, having been around this for a while, it's going to become an industry where, you know, people who are, I don't know what job position it is, but will eventually, I assume, be regarded like a great is in, certainly in design, like they'll be like a Saul Bass or whatever,
yeah.
you know, in web design, I assume.
It's so interesting to think of who that would be.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, is it the art director, or is it just some
mm-hmm.
front end coder who comes up with, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. It is interesting to think about how this is going to get canonized
mm-hmm.
in the same way. 'Cause it seems so much more like ethereal and fleeting than,
yeah, it does.
You know, than past forms.
That is my biggest worry about what I do, because when I design a website, I always think this has to last for 5 years. And in the web design industry, that's crazy talk.
5 years is like forever.
Yeah. Like, that would be great if that were true.
Yeah.
Clients always kind of chuckle, like, that'd be great if I didn't have to redesign my website for 5 years.
Yeah.
But if you were to say that to someone who was designing, you know, I don't know, a Bible, you know,
no.
like the Gutenberg Bible, that thing stands up, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's been lots of design over the years that, like, you still go back to, like, the 72 Olympics, and it's just like, how did they do that? That's
yeah.
so great. That's
yeah.
just perfect, classic, like, you can't improve on it.
Right.
So, yeah.
No, and it does, I don't know about you, but I'm starting to get to that, you know, wonderful midlife existential kind of space where you really start evaluating everything that you're doing against the end game, you
mm-hmm.
know? Like,
mm-hmm.
what's the long view on that?
Yeah.
And what's going to remain? And does it have to? Maybe it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just the doing is enough. But these are the questions that I think you confront mid-career, where it's not so much that hungry time of just like do.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you want to have more of a sense of where you're going and what's gonna be the artifact of all those efforts.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is, I have two little kids now, as you mentioned, which is, to circle back to creative mornings, a big part of the reason why I like it so much being in the morning, because I can actually go.
Yeah.
It would be, there's no way that my wife and I could both go to something that was...
In the evening,
that would be so hard to manage, then you're juggling. But it's like in the morning, that's great. It just gets you fired up on your work day. But on the subject of like timelessness of design, I would love to be making websites that I would feel confident that when my daughters grow up, they'll be able to see what their dad did. And it wouldn't just like be like, oh, you used a blink tag? hopefully it's never to that
level.
Oh,
dad.
That's right. We prefer a scrolling marquee. But, do you have a dream interview for Creative Mornings or a dream host for that?
For Creative Mornings?
I mean you've already had some pretty amazing
talks. I go after all the interesting people. There are some folks that are, elusive. And I won't even name check them because some of them are like...
Sure, yeah.
Some of them are like, I actually am just... never gonna do that for reasons that I don't care to share.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I'm basically always on the lookout for what's interesting. And now that we're doing themes, it's more challenging because before it was just like, let's line up cool person after cool person.
Mm-hmm.
Great job. I would just come across someone amazing and be like, I can put you on next month. Mm-hmm. Now it's a lot more challenging, which is great because it forces you to go out of your comfort zone a little bit and be like, all right, what am I going to do about the theme backwards? Forces you to think, in a little bit more of a targeted way. And it changes the way you keep your feelers out because you're kind of putting everything against this list that you have in your mind going like,
interesting. Now it's turned into like a puzzle for you.
Yeah, a little bit.
Backwards. How could this person be backwards?
Yeah. Backwards was one of the most interesting themes because...
Who was the one who was backwards?
So we had Mira Kadura,
okay,
who did a project called The Wonder Clock that was counting down her fertility. And so that was the backwards angle, right?
Okay.
It was a countdown. It was time,
yeah,
right?
Okay.
Seattle had a typographer who works with the Arabic alphabet.
Okay.
Which is sort of backwards in that they read right to left and we read left to right. But I think if you're really being accurate about it, we're backwards.
Right, right.
They were there first.
Exactly.
So yeah, but that
was like Portland nailed that one. Come on.
But I mean, it was really interesting to see how it was getting interpreted, and that's the whole beauty of the themes is that now that there's so much content coming out every month,
mm-hmm,
I mean 70 videos a month. Come on, who's gonna watch even a fraction of that?
Wow.
I
had no idea it was that many.
Right. So basically, there needs to be some thread between them that will compel somebody to watch more than one.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just a gigantic cacophony, you know? So it's been challenging but really fun. And in a way, it kind of, I think, reinvigorates hosts that have been doing it for a long time and are like, okay, another cool person. This is more just like, oh, okay, I really need to think of... who are we going to have for Rebel,
mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So I'm enjoying that, but it is more challenging. It's definitely more challenging. And there are months where it's nail biting. You're like, I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed for a while it seemed like you had a regular venue and now you've been moving around. Is there a reason for that? Do you find it more interesting if that changes up?
I think it is more fun for the audience, mm-hmm, when we change up because you get to see different spaces and it draws different people because for some people it's more convenient to be on the west side and some on the east side.
As you might imagine, the last location was very convenient for us.
Very convenient for you. Yes. So there is a fun factor. It's more complex for us to move around, obviously, because
right,
there's a new kind of new set of...
Got to learn how sound is going to work again.
Environmental challenges in each place. But we're enjoying kind of moving it around. But to answer your question more directly, we were at Zeba, for many of our events because they were so generously hosting us. Every time we're in there, they're paying for us to be in there.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of an effort to relieve some of the, the pressure on any given venue to kind of pony up for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, because we're a free event, we have small sponsorships that cover breakfast, essentially, and a little bit for videography and photography and stuff, but that's it. And so any place where we are is hosting us for free, and that's a lot to ask, you know? So, we're just trying to mix it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Well,
Celie, thank you so much for coming in today.
It was my pleasure entirely.
It was a great conversation, and I look forward to more amazing creative talks that you put on.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you there.
Thanks.
All right.
So, that...
Yeah?
That party we ended up
going
to at the coffee conference...
The warehouse party?
Yes.
Cafe
you say it was a warehouse, but were we indoors or were we outdoors?
Yeah, it had high ceilings. It was a warehouse.
I thought we were in an alley. I thought we were outside.
Oh, no.
Oh. I thought we were like between buildings in this. Interesting. That's a really narrow warehouse, sort of.
Well,
Are you
saw
sure?
It, oh, yeah. Yeah. You saw it opened up and back.
Yeah.
So I think that what's cut out of it basically seemed like maybe it was a Cafe Vita storefront or roastery. And so you walk in and it's like a fairly narrow thing, but you notice how we were sitting on green coffee bags. Like I think that
I did not notice that it was...
You were drunk before we even got there.
No. No way.
And they had a bar and they had moved in a pizza oven, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. Although we did... Find a where were we before that? First, we were at that little place right outside of Sitka and Spruce, which has just bottles of wine sitting on tables stacked, and you just walk over and grab one and start drinking it, which is amazing. And then after that, we found an alehouse. It was
we were at Capital Cider.
That's cider.
It is at seattleciderbar.com. It was, if you like cider,
it was pretty
holy
amazing.
Shit.
Yeah.
Like they had cider.
Yeah.
We just tried all kinds of cider. But
that's not alcoholic, so I had a few of those.
Yeah,
that
no,
was a break.
I think it's just the same as apple juice. Yeah, so you were wasted. We went to a party.
I was not wasted, but okay.
Had a blast and
I walked perfectly fine in and out of that party.
You did. You did. It was a different night that you had.
Oh my god.
But and remember we tried to stop into what was that bar like that Machiavelli? And
I think that
was
like
so,
more of a dinner place.
So Machiavelli's.
Yeah.
It was so crowded. You could not even get in the door.
Yeah.
And still we ran into people we knew.
And trying to get a table at Sitka and Spruce, there was a two-hour wait, which that's very Portland-like. At least I felt
at
home
then.
Yeah,
that felt like right at home.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, sure.
2 hours.
That's not bad.
It's a two-hour wait, but then they have a bar right outside with just bottles lining the tables. It's like, just go grab a bottle of wine and sit down and enjoy it. Like, what if all Portland restaurants had that? It's going to be 2 hours, but just go pick from this stack of wine and enjoy.
Portland was the first place I saw, and I'm sure this did not start in
this
Portland.
This did not impress you.
But,
this was amazing.
No. Of, like, bars opening right next to hip restaurants where people have to wait. And then making a killing.
So smart, yeah.
I remember that, cannot remember his name. He used to run Alto. He had opened a coffee shop on Upper Hawthorne. And then a pizza place went in right next to it. A really good pizza place, a nationally known pizza place, and all of a sudden,
national
is award winning, and so there would be a line of people out there every night. So he started serving
beer and wine. He probably should have started serving liquor too. Mm-hmm. But it was he didn't. I don't think he didn't do good enough at that. But really, that's a huge boost to business. They ended up basically he moved out and they took over. So now they're twice as big. They're just eating the competition. But or like C-Bar that opened next to Yoko's.
Yeah, which was first, though?
C-Bar was probably first, but once Yoko's lines started showing up, that drove out customers there. Like,
yeah.
Oh, or we could go here and get dinner or whatever.
I've hung out at C-Bar many a night waiting for a Yoko's
Same here. Signal. Yep. And then you finally get the call and you're like, well, fuck it, I'm drunk and I've already ordered food here. I'm just going to stay here. It's not true, but you know.
No.
We just lost our chi rating.
Oh, did we have a G rating?
Yeah. And we have a PG. Anyway, see you next week. Bye. Say bye.
Bye.